FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. This is the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is March 7th, 2018. Hey, as always, participate in the show. Send us an email to kl@kerrylutz.com. So trade wars look like they're in the offing. Is it just a matter of negotiation? Is there a bigger plan at work that you just don't know about? Well, here to opine on that topic is former Congressman John LeBoutelier. John, welcome back.
Hello, Kerry. It's great to be back. Before we're done on this show, I've got to take a moment to tell you a good story about tomorrow, March 8th, 47 years ago tomorrow. I got to tell you about what happened.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, that's the ultimate teaser. There's no way anybody's going to stop listening now. But on to tariffs. So we've got 25% tariffs on imported steel and 10% on aluminium, as the Brits would call it. And is that good for the U.S. or is it going to ignite a trade war?
Right. So first question is, will these tariffs actually be put in place? Because the president announced them last week as a surprise without any of the departments being ready to implement them. The legal work, the Treasury, none of the work has been done yet, but it's getting done now. And I think the world is waiting to see if he really will go ahead with this or not. I assume he is going to go ahead with it. But already, he gave an interview yesterday where he talked about possible exemptions being Canada and Mexico. If NAFTA could be successfully renegotiated, then they would get exemptions from these tariffs. European Union's all upset, talking about tariffs being put on various industries here. So I think the thing is, as we record this, very much up in flux. It has already caused the economic advisor to the president, Gary Cohn, to leave. Not that anybody really going to lose any sleep over it, but it does show that this is an emotional issue. And, you know, most Republicans are free traders, don't believe in tariffs. And most Democrats do, especially from blue collar Rust Belt states where Trump won. And so you have a funny sort of reversal where a Republican president is advocating a long time progressive tenet, tariffs, and his own party is quite against it. And that is also in the backdrop of this decision.
Well, I read somewhere, and I don't know if you caught this article, but there's some Chinese aluminum magnate, and he has shipped 2 billion pounds of aluminum that is sitting in a Mexican desert waiting to be shipped into the U.S. as a product of Mexico. And, you know, things like that. Then you look at the imported steel that we've gotten, a lot of it of dubious quality. Look at the crumbling Oakland Bay Bridge that was just put in service a few years ago. It's corroding. And is it a national security issue here that we get high-quality steel?
Yes. Well, no question. It's not. And that's the clause in the National Security Act that the president is using to unilaterally be able to put on these tariffs without congressional approval. Under the law, he can do it if it's a national security issue. And absolutely, steel especially is. You can't build fighter jets and military equipment without good steel. Now, I saw an economist this morning from Tufts on TV talking about our steel industry. And he said, actually, the steel industry in the United States is in very good shape. It's the steel workers who are not in good shape because our steel is now highly automated. Our steel plants are highly automated and steel workers have been laid off. And we're making enough steel and we're making good steel at these plants, but not enough workers are working there anymore. And that fits with what has happened economically in those regions around Pennsylvania, Ohio, you know, where the economies have been depressed for 30 years.
Yeah. Well, we also see, though, that with aluminum, half the smelters in the country have closed down over the past few years. And we're looking at these countries often exporting subsidized products to the country. Now, on the one hand, you love to say, hey, if China or Germany wants to subsidize our consumers and lower prices, that's a great thing and we should do it. On the other hand, we do have the national security issues and also the subsidy issues. I mean, we're not pure on that either. There's plenty of industries subsidized directly and indirectly by the U.S. government. But you would think with the tax cut, which is something we should probably talk about as well, you think with the tax cut, the profits of these industries are going to recover and make them more competitive. That's what I thought was going to happen.
Well, and they might. And here's the thing. Subsidizing an industry is a way to get into this game without having a trade war with the blowback, because you know what's going to come. If he puts these tariffs on, there will be retaliation by even our by China for sure, but by our allies in Europe too. And who's going to suffer? Our consumers are going to suffer by paying higher prices, and our workers are going to lose jobs. And so it is true. Nobody wins a trade war. And I think we shouldn't cavalierly rush into this thing thinking it's going to be a panacea here. It's not going to be.
No, definitely not. You can kind of see the writing on the wall. Because then step two, he already said, is if Germany retaliates, the EU retaliates, he's going to put a duty on cars and imported vehicles. And where does it end? Is this Smoot-Hawley redux? I mean, there is some legitimate concern here over the steel and aluminum industries, but you have to look and say, what are they going to do? They're going to raise their prices, right? I mean, isn't that inevitable, John?
So let me tell you, if I were the president, I would not do this. I would have the same concern Trump does over the workers in those states that he won, that he promised he would make their lives better. And he's trying to do that. So I'm not being critical of him for effort, but I think it's the wrong way to help them. I think tariffs are inevitably going to plunge us back into a slowing economy just at a time when the economy is really picking up steam. Why do this now? This is not the time to do it. Why endanger this economic recovery by possibly leading us into this full-blown trade war? Much better move for these workers would be, and I hate to say it, but this is another part of the Trump transformation of the Republican Party, is let's do a big infrastructure program that's going to spend more money, but is going to hire a lot of these workers in where they live to build bridges, roads, tunnels, track beds, airports, bus stations, all that stuff. It is in the Trump wheelhouse, Kerry. What was Trump? A builder. Mm-hmm. And he could say to America, we're going to rebuild this country. And there he would bridge the gap in partisanship. The Democrats love spending money like crazy.
Yeah.
And that would be better than what is coming with this trade war, which will threaten our economic recovery. Could plunge us into a recession. It could,
Well, while we're on the issue of trade, and I tend to agree with you, tariffs usually wind up accomplishing the opposite of what they're intended to accomplish. There are some national security concerns here for sure, and maybe there is a better way of doing it. But if we look at what's happened with the U.S.'s trade picture with Canada and Mexico since the adoption of NAFTA, we see that the U.S. had a trade surplus with Canada. It's now gone to like a $17 billion a year trade deficit. They're not taking our milk. So we basically said, well, we're not going to take your wood. And that's where we're at with them. With Mexico, we had a trade surplus. Now we have a $71 billion deficit. I'm not one to say that deficits or surpluses are good or bad, but certainly it seems like NAFTA was not the most optimal deal for the U.S., especially because China uses Canada and Mexico as kind of transshipment points for their products. So they get made in Canada on them or made in Mexico. So they enter the U.S. free of tariffs. I mean, how much longer can we go on like that?
Yeah, well, and by the way, the precursor of Donald Trump during the NAFTA debate said, what you're going to hear with this debate is a giant sucking sound.
Yes.
And it's going to be the sound of jobs and factories being sucked out of the United States down to Mexico. Of course, that was Ross Perot.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right.
Yeah, he was absolutely right. I didn't believe it.
So I give Trump credit. He's trying to keep a campaign promise. No secret that for, I remember in the 80s, he was talking about getting ripped off in trade by then Japan when they were the number one trading partner. They've had a correction since then, but Trump has been on this for a long time. But I think it's the right sentiment, wrong solution.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think the U.S. has a lot of leverage over these places, and he doesn't seem like he's one to not exercise leverage when he's got it. So do a more viable solution that helps those people, and maybe it's quotas. I don't know the answer. Quota is really not much different than a tariff when you get down to it, but they seem to work better than tariffs. Or maybe you just leave the thing alone, knowing that, like, Airbus was heavily subsidized, is heavily subsidized by the EU.
And we're still paying them. Yeah,
exactly the point. And that's what Milton Friedman said. Let all these countries subsidize everything. They're just subsidizing taxpayers. But there hasn't been a power like China, who is an economic mercantilist entity who's seeking economic world domination. And you have to think about that. So we never had a chance to talk about the tax reform bill. Obviously, as a New Yorker, you're one of the losers, assuming you're paying more than $10,000 in state and local taxes, which I'm sure you are. It's bad news for New York, isn't it?
Bad news. It's bad news, yeah, for high tax states where you can't deduct more than 10 grand, as you said, of state and local taxes and property taxes and all. And that will cost us politically some seats in the House in November, I have no doubt.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it did and is doing what we Republicans have always thought tax cuts will do. You put more money back in the hands of business owners and private people, and they'll spend the money more wisely. And it has happened right from the get-go. And the economy has picked up somewhat since the tax bill. And I'm not sure the full benefits have even been felt yet because people haven't paid their first income tax. Hopefully, they're going to see something in April that makes them even happier.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. It's a net positive. Look, when the thing was being debated, did you ever anticipate all these companies raising their workers' pay and giving them bonuses? I mean, I knew that it was going to eventually spur employment because psychologically it was a real shot in the arm for the economy that people saying, like, hey, there is a future to invest in productive assets in America. But I never foresaw how quickly it was going to flow through to the workers, which has to be good for the economy.
Right. I think what they did, I'm not sure about pay increases. I think what these companies have done is they did the $1,000 bonuses quickly in December to get the full benefit of deducting it as a necessary and ordinary business expense in the 2017
exactly.
tax year. Now, they didn't raise, most of them, as I understand it, have not raised their pay. They just did the one-time bonus. Now we'll see this year what they do. But hey, it's good that they gave people money. I think that's great. Right. The big thing, though, that we got to watch carefully for is, will there be overall statistically steady wage increases? Because we haven't had that. We've had wage stagnation for more than a decade or almost 20 years.
Exactly.
And, yeah, people are employed, but they're not really making enough money. They got to start making more money. And that's what we got to look for. Will there be real wage growth as a result of this tax bill?
Well, certainly at AT&T, they raised their minimum wage for any employee of AT&T to $15 an hour. You'd think the unions
that's
would
good.
Be ecstatic. Walmart raised their minimum wage to $1,000. They gave a bonus of $1,000. They raised their minimum wage to $11 an hour. Now you could say, well, you know, they're crumbs like Nancy Pelosi. That doesn't seem like a really wise strategy in countering why the tax cut bill didn't get one single Democratic vote, does it?
No. And it's not crumbs, you know, it's something. It doesn't mean it can't go up even more. So I think that's all good. I think that tax bill, more and more polls show people now approve of that bill. They had heard a bad side to it.
Yeah.
Heard was typical left-wing stuff, that business is evil, profit is evil, and making money is evil. Mm. And it's not. When companies make money, everybody makes money.
Absolutely.
Not just shareholders, but the workers should, in a normal economy, better also.
No question. You don't have to be Milton Friedman or Ludwig von Mises to figure this one out. And, hey, let's not forget those workers. A lot of them in the Rust Belt, which basically handed Trump the presidency. When you get down to it, it all came down to the industrial Midwest. A lot of them are getting, in addition to the $1,000 bonus, they're saving, you know, anywhere from $1,500 to $3,500 a year in taxes, which if you're making $50,000, $75,000, that's a substantial amount of money to wind up with after taxes that you can actually do something with, like buy a flat screen TV, pay down some debt, throw some money into retirement, all of these beneficial effects. You know, obviously, John, the tax cut was not designed with you or I in mind. They didn't care about us. We're not the majority of the voters. And hey, but honestly, the people who needed it the most, the people who are getting it. So that's a good thing. So tell us what happened 47 years ago, John.
Well, this whole interview has been about, you know, one side versus the other, tariffs, Europe versus us. Well, 47 years ago tomorrow night was the single greatest event I ever attended.
Oh, my God. Oh.
And it was
I'm sitting
it
down.
Was a conflict. It was a conflict, and the world paid attention to it. And it was the biggest sporting event
I know.
In the history of the world.
I know what you're going to tell me. Yes.
First Ali Frazier fight at Madison Square Garden, March 8, 1971. And Muhammad had just come out of retirement, where he'd been forced out because of the draft. And he was undefeated. And Joe Frazier was undefeated. And I went to that thing with my father. And it was, to this day, it was the greatest event I've ever been to. Other people who went say the same thing. It had an energy to it, Kerry, like nothing you have ever sensed. It was huge.
Yes. Huge,
and
with a capital
no
Y.
Since then has come close either.
You're so correct. Okay, so you got a couple of years on me, not that many. I was in junior high school. That's what they used to call middle school. And we were all a tizzy over it. And it was the most amazing fight of all time. I remember we actually made up songs in our music class about the fight. I could still remember the song. I wrote it myself. And not that I'm a songwriter, and I'm not going to sing it now because I have a lousy voice, but we got the award for best song in that class. And I'll recount one other thing. I was traveling to Chicago to see my sister. She lived there at the time. And, you know, I'm like 13 years old, and who's at the airport but Muhammad Ali. And he's nicely dressed in a suit. Probably be wearing a hoodie now, or, you know, crappy clothes.
He was always pretty well
dressed. Yeah, he was, but his contemporary now, you know, because standards are so much different.
And he
had an air of nobility about him. And my brother-in-law gave me his pen and a card and said, go ask him for his autograph. And I did. And all these people were around him. He had just been stripped of his title. And he had a sense of nobility and class about him. And he was the sweetest person. He said, sure. And he wrote my name and he wrote out the autograph. Of course, I lost it. Damn it. But
oh, my God, you fool.
Yeah, I know. Who could have thunk? Who would have thunk? And but that image of him, you know, changed me in so many ways, because the media was telling you one thing, you know, he's a draft dodger, et cetera, and not to be looked up to. But the person himself just had this integrity about him, John. And
it's huge.
45 years ago, I still remember it.
49
years ago, right? I was 11.
This is 47 years ago. He got stripped I think in 68, maybe 67 or 8 of his title.
Right.
When he refused to step forward at the induction ceremony to be drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And his argument, obviously, is against the war and all. He's a Muslim, and he said, we don't believe in fighting and all that. But he made a great point in a lot of interviews. He said, well, I'll go in the army. I'm not going to fight. I'll fight exhibitions. I pay more money every year in federal tax. I pay for a fighter jet every year.
Yeah.
And you could keep getting that from me if you let me keep fighting.
Yeah.
You know?
But I actually read a book about it many years later about what really happened. He wasn't the brightest guy. He had failed the fitness, the intellectual part of the fitness exam to go into the service. And LBJ was all upset, said he was draft dodging, gaming the system. You know, he wasn't the best student, let's face it. And they revised the test and dropped the score so that he would qualify and be eligible for the draft. So this is your government at work here. You know, this is the type of stuff they do. And it's so much worse what they do now than what they did 50 years ago. But it's 50 years since he lost. So I was 10 years old. I'm 60 now. 10 years old, he lost his title. It was a horrible thing that they did to him, singled out. And he truly was a conscientious objector, whether you agree with his religion or not. He was a conscientious objector. Should have never gotten to that point. Anyway, I really appreciate your bringing that up, John, because I think it's a lesson that needs to keep being learned about what happens when government power is abused. Next time we'll talk about FISA, we'll talk about FBI, we'll talk about mega texting. How do you text the same person 10,000 texts in a month if you're over the age of 15 and still actually get your job done? That's one I can't quite figure out, John, but evidently Peter Stroke was the master multitasker, right?
All right, we'll talk about it next time.
All right. Hey, John, just tell us your blog, where we find you, what you're doing these days.
It's johnlebout.com, johnlebout.com. And I do a podcast. It's available there or iTunes or SoundCloud called Revolution_the Podcast.
All right. I love it. Great, great branding title there. Somebody knew what they were doing when they picked that name. John, hey, really appreciate you coming on. It's always fun to talk with you. And let's see how this tariff debate finally works itself out, because I have a feeling it's going to be typical Trumpian. It'll work itself out in a way that you'd never anticipated, right?
Exactly.
All right.
If it happens at all.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Exactly. Yeah. Art of the deal.
Yeah.
All right, John. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kerry. Bye-bye.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.